This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to James J. Walter, Ph.D., who is the Austin and Anne O'Malley Professor of Bioethics and the Director and Chair of the Bioethics Institute at Loyola Marymount University here in Los Angeles. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Now, you're a bioethicist. Tell people what a bioethicist is as such.
Well, it's somebody who tries to study, figure out the various questions that come from the life sciences and the delivery of healthcare in the contemporary environment. So people are trained in one area, like philosophy or medicine, and then they generally try to get trained in two other areas in order to handle this multidisciplinary field.
So it's very much a cross-disciplinary effort.
Presumably
you're able then both to be knowledgeable in the different areas and maybe synergize the metaphors and models that you use in the different fields to come to some kind of integrated position on everything.
That's what we do.
How much of your work in your day-to-day work is theoretical? How much of it is it instructional, and how much is it practical?
Well, let me start with the beginning of the week. Every Monday, I'm in an intensive care unit at St. Francis Medical Center in Linwood, California. It's the largest ICU in L.A. County. Most of the patients there are African-American and Hispanic. Most don't have insurance. So I spend a good part of the day dealing with patient care, decision-making over treatment decisions, withdrawal of treatment, things of that sort, and then the rest of the week I direct the Bioethics Institute, which collaborates with three major medical centers in LA with the university, and I'm starting a new department of bioethics at Loyola Marymount University in bioethics. It'll be a graduate program, master's program, and I teach physicians, attorneys, social workers, nurses, people of that sort. So I do that the rest of the week.
So there's a little bit in the ivory tower and a lot in the trenches and the rest in between.
One informs the other.
Right.
It goes actually from the beginning of the week to the end of the week. So my experience of being in the ICU is actually the situation out of which I do my more constructive work in bioethics. Yes.
Okay. So you're almost literally hands-on with day-to-day life and death decisions that other people are making, presumably with your advice about disease and its effect on people.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk about Proposition 71. The proponents of that measure argue that spending $3 billion on embryonic stem cell research will alleviate a tremendous amount of human suffering in vast populations of patients with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and other devastating diseases, and in many cases will reduce the suffering of members of their own families. What do you say to that as an ethical argument?
Well, everything that you said with that long sentence is correct, except you put an indicative or future, it will alleviate.
Yes.
And really what you need to do is to put a subjunctive, it may.
Right.
Well, they don't know. I mean, nobody knows right now, and if we knew about this for sure, don't you think that all of the pharmaceutical companies would be jumping on this? So, because we don't know, it's really not proven, and even if the stuff does work, it's still a question of whether it won't be so expensive, because each one of these things would have to be tailored to an individual patient, and that's going to make the pharmaceutical company's life pretty difficult. So they see that as an extremely expensive kind of endeavor to develop these kinds of cell lines that would all have to be tailored to individuals anyhow, unless somebody's able to create a generic kind of a therapy that can be applied to any number of people. In Europe, they're doing this with umbilical cord blood, and they're trying to create a generic kind of therapy for various disabilities.
One cell fits all, essentially.
There's a way in which that could be done. It's a question of whether embryonic stem cell, that would work with embryonic stem cells.
Okay. Could you differentiate on a scientific or medical level between or and among cord blood stem cells, adult stem cells, and embryonic stem cells?
Okay, let's start with embryonic stem cells first. They are a part of the five-day-old embryo called the blastocyst, and at 5 days there's an inner cell mass and an outer cell mass. The outer cells will become the placenta and supporting structures when the embryo embeds into the uterine wall. The inner cell is the embryoblast. That's where the embryo will develop into a fetus and then into a newborn child. And it's those cells in the inner cell mass that called pluripotent stem cells that they want to strip out and then put into a petri dish and add chemicals to make them differentiate into different kinds of cells. Hypothetically, those cells can become all of the 210 cell types in the body. They can become heart cells, they can become liver cells, fingernails, and so on.
Right, and in fact, that's what they do, because it is out of those cells that the entire body eventually develops, and therefore, if you grab them at this early stage, before they've differentiated themselves, they may be capable of being manipulated into becoming cells of various types at the whim or desire of the researcher.
Correct.
Okay. Doing that, of course, is a process that destroys the blastocyst embryo, right?
Yes, it has to.
Okay. So why don't we just talk a little bit here on the, apart from the biology, although of course it's inextricably linked, on the morality or ethics or the different views of what it is that blastocyst is. Principally, is it human life or is it not human life?
Okay, maybe a better way of framing it is, does what is growing there have any moral standing?
That's just what I wanted to address, right?
Most of us would say, of course, it's human life because it's not frog life, it's not tree life, it has 46 chromosomes, so it's human life. The question is whether it has any moral and legal standing in society. There are
right.
three views on that. Very quickly, those who believe that it has absolutely no moral or legal standing, that it's like a tumorous mass that can be excised because it doesn't have any kind of standing. That's one view. The other end of the spectrum is that it has moral standing from the beginning of conception. President George W. Bush takes that view. The Catholic tradition takes that view. A number of other people in society take that view. Then there's a middle position that at 5 days it doesn't have complete moral standing. It has one should give moral respect for what is there, but it's not yet a person and doesn't have the full rights of what a newborn child would have. So it has a kind of standing as the President's Commission, the minority report of President Bush's Bioethics Commission, that was asked to study this question. The minority position on that commission described the embryo at this stage as having intermediate status. It doesn't have full moral standing.
Okay, well, so obviously if it's a tumor and has no status, you can do whatever you want with it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If it's a human life and has the rights of human life,
standing.
It has moral standing, then you can no more destroy it than you can destroy a living human being.
Correct, or create embryos to destroy them, which is what Proposition 71 is about now. I think we have to be clear what Proposition 71 is about. It's not taking leftover embryos in vitro fertilization labs. You know, couple comes in, they can't have a child, they do what's called in vitro fertilization. They fertilize an egg in a petri dish, and then they transfer some of those embryos into the woman's uterus to see if they will actually develop into fetuses. And leftover embryos are then frozen and put away in a lab in case the couple wants to have other children. And sometimes couples have a couple of children, and then they just leave those frozen embryos in labs. And so some countries only permit the kind of research on embryos that are left over in these IVF labs. But Proposition 71 goes way beyond that. It not only uses frozen embryos, it will create embryos, what are called research embryos, to be destroyed, and further, it will clone embryos. It will use the technique that was that Ian Wilmot in Scotland used when he cloned Dolly the sheep, that kind of procedure. We can also clone humans, not for reproductive purposes, not to bring these embryos to term, but rather to a live birth, in other words, but rather to create embryos to strip out these pluripotent stem cells.
Now, I did an interview with Wesley Smith, another bioethicist, about 2 weeks ago, and he stressed that cloning is cloning, he said, and it doesn't matter whether the intention for it is, quote, therapeutic or, quote, reproductive. You're doing the same thing and creating the same thing. Was that pretty accurate?
Well, I mean, it's accurate to a point.
Right.
Yeah, you're creating a life, an embryo, by doing the cloning procedure. But there's a big difference between trying to implant that embryo in a woman's uterus and grow it to term, because there are all kinds of damage that could result from that procedure in a human child.
It took several hundred attempts to get Dolly the sheep.
200, but
yes.
You know, a sheep's brain is not a human brain, and therefore we really don't know all of the neurologic damage that was maybe in Dolly, and maybe it wouldn't even show up in a very rudimentary brain that doesn't have the kind of sophistication of a human brain. And we also know that Dolly was 6 years old when she was born, so you know, in terms of her what are called telomeres, these kind of in tails that are on our chromosomes, every time the cell reproduces itself, part of these telomeres or these little tails are lost. And you know, you can see how old chronologically a mammal is by examining the telomeres. So you can do that with any kind of creature by measuring its telomeres. And Dolly was already 6 years old because the cell that was used from the adult ewe, the mammary cell, that ewe was already 6 years old.
So there are plenty of problems with that. Can cord blood stem cells and adult stem cells offer significant benefits for patients, do you think?
Well, cord stem cells are more like fetal embryonic cells now, because they fit generally into that category. The other kind that you're speaking about, adult or multipotent stem cells, come from the adult body.
Right.
You don't have to be an adult. You could be a one-day-old infant.
Right.
Those cells are taken from there.
Fully born humans.
Yes. Well, the thing is that many patients have been helped with cord blood stem cells or from adult stem cells already. Nobody's been helped from embryonic stem cells, so that's where we stand right now.
Okay, if we could focus on something you've said a little bit about, and maybe expand on it. Proponents of Prop 71 argue that embryonic stem cell research, apart from whatever moral problems there are with it, as we've discussed, will save Californians billions in health costs. Now, today's high-tech medicine is much more expensive than the lower tech of yesteryear. Won't any treatments developed from Prop 71 research be even more expensive than the ones we have now?
Well, probably will be, and let me just because I want to make the point that many people believe that this issue of pluripotent stem cells now, not adult stem cells,
right,
not cord blood stem cells,
right,
but embryonic stem cells, rises or falls with whether or not the embryo has any moral and legal standing.
Right.
I think that's a significant moral issue, obviously. But it's not the only issue. And you're asking me, you know, isn't this going to be much more expensive? Yes, it's going to be very expensive, and who's going to get access to it? This is going to be a question of justice, which is another moral issue. If we believe that there is a trickle-down theory in medical care in this country, as Reagan proposed, trickle-down economics with his Reaganomics theory, may work in economics. It does not work in healthcare. We wouldn't have 45 million Americans under the age of 65 who have relatively no access to healthcare because they don't have insurance, and another 35 million who have such a small amount of insurance that they could probably take their child to get strep throat diagnosed and get amoxicillin, but they wouldn't be able to handle cancer if someone in the family got that. So this stuff is not, even if it does become less expensive, why do we believe suddenly that this is going to be available to all of the patients I see every Monday who are African-American and Hispanic populations living off Watts, who somehow or another are suddenly going to get access to this when they don't get access to medication to control their high blood pressure, when I see so many of them in an ICU now with kidney failure, strokes, heart attacks in their 40s. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. We're
right.
paying for all of their health care when if we could have just gotten them a Diovan, which would control their high blood pressure, or a medication similar to that, it would cost $20, $30 a month. Now we're going to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars with people who are permanently damaged. So it doesn't make any sense. And that kind of talk about we're going to do this high-tech interventionist medicine, we're going to get this down to a real science, we're going to be able to get the cost down, and then people are going to get access to it. That just doesn't work in the United States. We're the only country in the developed world, 56 countries, that do not have any universal health care access.
And this certainly isn't going to provide it. What would you say the ethics is on sort of the flip side? You've just talked about the availability of these hypothetical cures. Assuming that there are breakthroughs and that there is a lot of money generated, what's the ethics of letting 30 million Californians pay $200 each to finance the research and then letting a small coterie of researchers, universities, biotech companies, and venture capitalists make the tens of billions of dollars on that investment?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sure, and it's not going to be $3 billion, it's going to be $6 billion, because when you add the interest in that, it's going to be more expensive.
Right.
And we're cutting back on our schools and on security and everything else in this state. We're swimming in red ink, and somehow or another, why didn't the legislature do this? Why didn't the big pharmaceutical companies underwrite this?
Why haven't the venture capital companies that are paying the $12 million so far to pass 71 done it?
Because they're not sure it's going to work.
Okay.
And that's the reason why the legislature didn't pass it. So when you fail on those two counts, your only alternative is to bring it to the people and have them vote it in. But, you know, these people are leading the Californians to believe that A, it's not legal in California to do stem cell research, and B, that it's not funded publicly. Both of those occur in California.
Right.
Governor Gray Davis did that in 2002. He signed a law allowing the creation of embryos with public funds. This isn't, you know, it. The proponents of this are trying to convince Californians that it's not legal in California to do this, and we're not already paying for it. It is legal, we are paying for it, and now they just want to up the ante to $6 billion.
Okay, now speaking of upping the ante, and we're getting close to the end here, the proponents of Prop 71 have already raised $12 million, and I haven't seen them spending any of it. This means to me that when October comes, they're going to be putting on a lot of TV commercials with people I admire, like Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve,
sure.
saying, help us, we're
right.
suffering. And they're going to say it over and over again, and people who are opposed to Prop 71 are going to be reduced to talking on California Politics Today and explaining what's going on. What's your take on that? What do you think people ought to do who feel that there's more to it than just appeals to emotion by people who are maybe doing it disingenuously in any case?
Well, they need to get educated. I think if you ask the typical person in the street, they really have very little understanding about stem cell research. They have very little understanding about Prop 71. And all they know is what the press has given them or what commercials have brought to them. I think they need to be educated about particularly what this proposition will do to California and what's really behind it. It's really fronting the scientists to do kinds of research that I'm guessing that if a lot of people really understood it, that what you're doing is you're cloning embryos to destroy them, would have more than a little bit of difficulty with that.
But as we all know from watching the presidential election campaign and everything else, it's image generated by money for TV commercials that create the way people think about things.
Yeah, that's what shapes public opinion.
So what, you have any clever psychological jujitsu that might be able to give more leverage to people who don't have $12 million?
I don't have any magic bullet that's going to do that. I mean, this is an extremely complex issue. I think there's enough being written in the popular press, whether it be in places like the LA Times or in Newsweek or Time Magazine or, you know, a number of things are coming out. The president of our university has just written several pieces that are going to be published in the popular press trying to detail the kind of ethical, financial, and scientific issues that are connected with it in a very short short space. So it isn't that these things aren't available. The question is, are people going to spend the 10 minutes it's going to take to kind of read that and say, okay, maybe I need to think about this a little bit more before I jump? Plus, they need to think about it more than just the killing of an embryo. Again, too many people believe this issue rises and falls with the status of the embryo, and it doesn't rise or fall with that. That's a significant and a very important issue. It's not the only one.
Okay. Enumerate the other ones.
Justice issues. Who's going to get access to it? Who's being denied health care right now? Do we need to rethink the standard paradigm of the medical system that we currently have that devotes so much time, energy, money, and personnel to very high-tech, interventionist, and expensive therapies, as opposed to providing blood pressure medication to a wide range of people who don't have insurance so that they don't have strokes and kidney failure and things of that sort? So why not put more money, a lot of this money, into preventative health care? Why aren't we doing that?
So essentially you're saying an ounce of prevention can be worth $10 billion worth
absolutely
of cure.
Okay. You're going to save a lot of money just at St. Francis if you gave people blood pressure medication, let me tell you.
All right. On that down-to-earth level, I think we can draw ourselves to a close here. I want to thank you very much for talking to us in California Politics today, and presumably and possibly we'll get back to you later in the campaign, and we can talk more about how things are going.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.